Welcome to the Single Greatest Choice podcast, where single women find support, empowerment, information, and inspiration around the topics of singleness, fertility, motherhood, and mindset. I'm your host, Katie B., and I'm thrilled to be back for a second season to share more stories of women like you and me who are navigating these choices, along with interviews with experts in the fields of fertility preservation, coaching, and psychology. Whether you're just starting to question what to do about your finite fertility, or whether you're ready to make the leap into solo motherhood by choice, I hope these conversations will help you to feel more supported and confident along the way. Because whatever you decide to do with these years could be the single greatest choice you'll ever make, and you don't have to make it alone. Hey, podcast listeners, welcome back for season two. I am thrilled to introduce you to our guest today. Dr. Tracy is a Black, immigrant, queer, single mama by choice. She's the host of the podcast Healthy, Wealthy Roots, a podcast about financial wellness, mental health, and parenthood. She creates content especially for people who look and or love like she does. Dr. Tracy was born and raised in Trinidad and Tobago and moved to the U.S. for college and grad school, where she studied child, adolescent, and family psychology. At 35, she became a single mother by choice after surviving an infertility diagnosis and pregnancy loss. Now she's raising a brown boy during the latest social justice movement. During the pandemic, she got serious about understanding finances and how money works. She became passionate about sharing this new knowledge, especially with Black and brown people. Her podcast, Healthy Wealthy Roots, is born from her life experiences. I know you guys are going to enjoy this conversation with Dr. Tracy. Hi, Dr. Tracy. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Just so happy to have you here. Will you tell us a little bit about who you are? And you can start wherever you want.
So I am a psychologist. My specialty is in child and family psychology. And so that's one of the hats that I wear. I am also now a mom. My son is a year and a half, and I am also an immigrant. I'm from Trinidad and Tobago. I moved here for college and then for grad school and have stayed. So I have set up roots here and I'm working in the children's hospital, taking care of my baby, and that's me.
Did you feel pressure to have life unfold in any sort of way? Like, I kind of feel like in the U.S. we have this love, marriage, baby, carriage. That's the order you're supposed to do things. Did you feel that pressure as well? Or is your culture structured?
We definitely have the same kind of structure. And a lot of the people in my country are very religious. And so there's also that expectation as well. And so my life kind of went on that trajectory. I met a guy and we were very much in love and we got married. We tried to have a child and eventually were diagnosed with unexplained infertility. Somewhere in there, I had a chemical pregnancy, an early miscarriage. And unfortunately, for other reasons, the marriage didn't work out. And so after going through divorce and kind of getting my bearings again, I still wanted to have a child. I've always loved children. I mean, my specialty is kids. So I decided that maybe I just need to go ahead and do it on my own.
Wow. And so what age were you, or about when was that in your life that you started thinking that way?
Yeah, so I started the process in 2018 in the summertime. And I think that was about 2 years after the divorce. After my divorce, I had been dating, and I date women, and kind of waiting to see if a long-term relationship would pan out. Mm-hmm. But for me, I have other factors at play that I think a lot of the choice moms don't. So I have this awareness because I work with kids, I kind of know some of the medical stuff and I'm more aware of, oh my goodness, this is what happens if you have a child past this age, because I see it. It's mm-hmm. what I work with. And on top of that, my mother had early menopause. She started menopause in her early 40s. And my older brother has Down syndrome. and you're more likely to have a kid with Downs after 35. So I just have all of those factors at play. And that led to me being like, okay, maybe I should just go ahead and do this because it's something that I've always wanted.
So from the time you started thinking about it to the time that you were ready to actually take action, did that take a long time? Was that a struggle, or did you feel pretty clear about the decision?
Well, the decision to have a child was always clear for me. It's just how.
Right.
And thankfully, my therapist, I'm a big advocate for therapy, not just because I am a therapist, but I believe in it. So my therapist and I went back and forth about it and what would happen if this and what would happen if that, or how would you handle this? How would you handle that? And that really helped. So I would say it was probably a conversation that we had over a couple of months before I went ahead and set up an appointment. The reproductive endocrinologist who I used, she's pretty popular. So I had to wait. I think I had to wait like a month and a half before I got in to see her. So that would have been the beginning of the summer in 2018. And it's so interesting because I feel like my infertility journey was longer than my choice mom journey, because I went in to see her at the beginning of the summer, and at the end of the summer, I was pregnant.
Wow, that is fast.
Yeah.
You know, I have heard so many women, and I've interviewed women on the podcast as well, who have had infertility struggles and had unexplained infertility with a partner.
Whatever that means.
Right. Right. And then go on to have a relatively easy journey on their own. You could contribute that to using a donor, but also I really believe in spirit babies and the idea that there is when we're meant to have a child, there's a particular child that's going to come at a particular time in a particular way. And it's just so interesting to me, different women and their conception journey. And it's not always linear. It doesn't always.
Exactly.
So when you started with your single mother by choice journey, did you do IUI or IVF, or how did you navigate that?
So I am a research nerd. I read and read and read and read probably too much. My mother says that I know too much. I also know my body very well, because for people who go on to be diagnosed with infertility, they've gone through some things. Mm-hmm. I have gotten to know my body in ways that I probably wouldn't have otherwise. I have peed on more sticks than I probably ever would for the rest of my life. So I trusted myself enough to do IUI, because I knew how to tell when I was ovulating. I knew how wide that window would be. And it's funny because I actually did have to end up advocating for myself with my RE's office. They wanted me to do the ovulation predictor kit at home. And I was also going in for ultrasounds to see when I would be ovulating. And I had the ultrasound in the morning. It was on a Sunday, but they're open every day because they're at the hospital. In the afternoon, I had a positive on the ovulation test kit. And I know my body. I was like, okay, I need to get in tomorrow morning. And when I called them, they were like, okay, well, you can come in tomorrow afternoon. And I was like, no, I need to come in tomorrow morning. They were like, okay. So thankfully I did and ended up pregnant.
What, was that your first IUI? Or did you do multiple?
It was.
Oh my goodness. That's amazing.
I know.
You're one of the unicorns.
Yep. When it's your time, it's your time, yeah. I guess.
That's amazing. So we skipped over this part a little bit, and feel free if you're not interested in discussing it, we don't have to, but I'm curious about your donor selection process.
Yeah, so that actually, for me, I did not spend as much time as some moms do. I am very much a go with my gut instinct kind of a person. And so, I mean, I've listened to your podcast and I kind of hear other women's stories. And when I started with my RE, they said that they only use 3 or 4 of the sperm banks. And so what I did was I just picked one. They had tested me and I'm CMV negative. So I knew that I needed to have a negative donor. And for most women, they just kind of go with that. But I actually know what kids look like when they're born and there's that issue. Some of my patients have hearing impairment and there are developmental delays. So I know firsthand how important that was. And that was very striking for me because initially I wanted to have a Black donor because I always thought I'd have a Black child as a Black woman. And I went on the Cryobank's website and I'm looking through their directory. And I went from like 400 or 500 people. And then when I did the filter for a Black CMV negative donor, it gave me one guy.
Yes. I'm not surprised.
Yeah. And he had like huge ears. And I was like, no, I am not doing this to my child. So I had to think about, okay, what's really important here? Do you want a kid? Do you want a Black kid? And either way, the kid would have been half of me anyway. So what I did then was I expanded my search to include mixed guys. From there, I wasn't sure exactly where that would take me. But this one kid, and my cryobank, it's only the kid pictures. He just stood out. And they give them like little nicknames. And his nickname is very much in line with one of my like hobby interests. Mm-hmm. And so I just felt like it was meant to be, which sounds so strange, but yeah. And so that's how I ended up choosing him.
Yeah. That it's really nice when it does feel right. So
yeah. And for me, I like freaked out because as you know, sperm can go very quickly. And so I was keeping an eye on it because I wasn't set yet on when my RE wanted me to buy and to go ahead and get the vial because I didn't have a date set. And I just saw like the bar for availability go down and down and down. And I logged in and it said no vials available. And I freaked out. I called that cryobank probably 6 times that day.
Oh,
they
no.
Probably thought, oh my goodness, this lady, because I was just trying to find out how I could possibly get vials because I was sure that he was quote unquote the one. Mm-hmm. And what ended up happening is they said that someone had put a bunch of his vials in their shopping cart and then they didn't check out. So the vials were still there. They just hadn't been paid for. And they were like, well, if you want it and you can pay for it right now, you can get it. So I ended up buying all of them.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So I used one and I have 2 remaining.
That's nice. Have you thought about a sibling? Do you think you might use those later down the line?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a big decision.
And yeah, it is a big decision. So initially, I did want to have 2 children, but I had a very difficult pregnancy, a very difficult labor and delivery. And the first year was also difficult, but it's kind of a blur now. And I cannot imagine myself doing this again on my own. Mm-hmm. So I'm holding on to my vials. They're in storage and I'll decide what happens.
Yeah. Would you like to talk about your pregnancy or delivery or both?
My baby made it very clear to me very early on that he was here to stay because I had severe cramping. I want to say it was about a week after my positive pregnancy test. I mean, days after I was having like increased sense of smell. I'm walking through the office and I turned to my coworker and I was like, what is that? And she's like, I have no clue. So it was very clear to me that I was truly pregnant, which was an interesting experience after my infertility journey. Shortly after that, I started having morning sickness and I got put on one medication and it wasn't enough. So then they had to double me up with another medication. I was on that and had morning sickness, which isn't even really morning sickness. It's whenever sickness, for the entire pregnancy. I know some women end up having to go into the hospital and are on bed rest, and that thankfully did not happen for me. I did have two hospital trips for fluids, for being dehydrated, one of which required an ambulance ride, which was interesting. So it was just difficult. And then the labor and delivery, there are things that people don't tell you. So I had contractions for a week before he was born. And it was Braxton Hicks. And so people don't tell you that it could last for a while. And so I'm grocery shopping, driving in traffic, just having contractions. And my mom had come from Trinidad to help me. And so at least I had that support. And then the delivery itself, I started having stronger contractions like 2 or 3 in the morning. I think my water broke like just around lunchtime. And he was born 11 at night on Mother's Day.
Aww.
So yeah, he was my Mother's Day present. But it was long and we required a vacuum extraction. So it was a bit scary towards the end, but he was fine. I was fine. We were able to come home.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad everyone was fine, but I can see why just going through that pregnancy would, you would not want to do that again anytime soon, especially while parenting a toddler at the same time.
Yeah, no. So. And he's a very active boy. So.
And you mentioned your mom coming to help you. Have you had much help other than that initial help? I mean, is family able to come or do you have friends nearby that can help? Or are you really pretty much on your own?
So my mom came for 2 months and that was absolute, like, I would not change that for the world. Those 2 months, they were very, very difficult. The baby had feeding issues and we were going to lactation consultants and the pediatrician to make sure that everything was going to be okay and you're not sleeping. And it was very difficult. So having her live in with me for 2 months was amazing. But after she left, it's pretty much been me on my own. My kid has like 3 babysitters, which is more babysitters than most kids have. But I need to have someone who's available. But other than that, after I went back to work, he started at daycare and his daycare has an aftercare. So on the days when I am just absolutely wiped out, once I'm done working, I just take a 1 hour nap while he's in aftercare and I then go get him for my second shift.
That's a good tip. I'm going to need to write that one down. Yes. My baby's due in April and I'm like, how am I going to do this? But that's a good tip.
I say maximize any help that you get. Yeah. And I have friends around and some of my friends have kids. So we do play dates and that really helps. So.
Yeah. In general, would you say family and friends have been supportive of the choice to become a single mother, or like, how has that been for you? The feedback from other people?
I think most people who know me personally know that I just kind of do whatever I want, whether or not they have an opinion about it. They kind of just accepted, okay, this is something that she's doing. I did have a lot of good support from my cousins because we're really close and we talked about it. And some of my close friends were very excited from the very beginning. I also have a really good relationship with my ex-husband. We were together for, goodness, was it 10 years, 8 years, something like that? A really long time. I've known him for a really long time. And he was very supportive and he still is. So I had that support. The only real opposition that I had actually was from my mother. in the beginning. She's very opinionated, just like I am. It's probably where I get it from. And she let me know that it was probably not a good idea to try to have a baby on my own and that it would be very difficult. And she was right. Yes, it is very difficult, but I am glad that I did it. She came around to the idea while I was pregnant. And I just kept sharing what I was going through and sending her the ultrasound pictures. And so by the time I got to like my second, third trimester, she was very excited because it's her only grandbaby. Mm-hmm. And I think that rules over everything else. And now she spoils him rotten.
So. Oh, that's sweet. So we've talked about some of the challenges, and I think a lot of women go into this worried about how am I going to manage, and this is going to be hard. And you've kind of said, you know, it has been hard, and that is not a surprise to anyone. But what are some of your favorite parts of being a single mother by choice?
I get to enjoy him by myself, which has its pros and its cons. I mean, yes, you want to share good experiences with a romantic partner, but at the same time, there are just these special moments that it's just going to be me and him. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really, really special. Because I'm a child psychologist, it's also fascinating for me to see the theory in practice and to see the development blossoming, because this is what I do for work, but mm-hmm. actually getting to live in with that experience is absolutely amazing. And he's a cute kid, so he has quite a fan club, and he's very charming, and there are aspects of his personality that I am sure came from the donor, because they're just so not me at all. And the donor did say that he was outgoing and friendly, and my kid is too. And as far as I know, some of the siblings are very similar as well.
Are you in touch with any of the donor sibling families?
Yes, I am. So when I had him, I created our section on the sibling registry for our cryobank. And so I just sat there and waited. And it was probably about a month and a half in when we have twins, siblings. And so their mom signed up, and she and I started texting and exchanging pictures. And so now I actually checked the registry today. We have, it's 10 of them, 10 kids. So we have 9 siblings so far. And the donor is no longer active. He hasn't been active for a while. So he was only active, as far as I know, for a year and a half or two. And so I'm not sure how many siblings we'll end up having, but the moms created a private Facebook group, and some of the moms are on there. Some of the moms haven't really been maintaining contact, but right now we have contact with about, I want to say it's about 5 of the kids. And that's been really cool.
Okay. I'm so curious about your experience here, because this is one of those things that I just don't know what I think yet. I haven't decided. So I'm aware of, I think, 3 or 4 families who share my donor. And I know of this because I got into the Facebook group for my sperm bank, and I just typed in my donor number and I found them, and the kids are very cute and the people seem very, you know, personable, and you know, there was nothing weird about it, but I kind of freaked myself out and then left the group and was like, I don't know if I can do this. And so I haven't decided. I mean, I'm currently pregnant and I haven't decided, do I connect with these people now? Do I wait until after the baby comes? Do I wait until he's old enough to decide if he wants to be in touch? Does your son know? I mean, I know he's really little, but like, is he going to be aware that he has donor siblings? Are you going to wait? And like, what is all
that? Yeah, those are really good questions. So it's such a personal choice. I have friends who are married lesbians and they used a donor to conceive and they've decided that they have no interest in connecting with siblings. And for me, I'm just like, oh my goodness, we have a new one. I'm so excited. So it really exists on a spectrum and it's such a personal choice. I wanted to wait until after I had him just because I didn't know what was going to end up happening with the pregnancy. So once I had him, I signed up. And what mattered most to me is I wanted him to feel connected with other people. I wanted him to, because at this point, we don't know who the donor is. And I did do an open ID donor, but we don't know if he'll ever have contact with the donor or the donor's family. And so I wanted him to have the option to connect with his blood relatives. And that's why it was important for me to see if we could connect with siblings. He has not done like FaceTime or anything with any of them yet. We've talked about doing that. If it wasn't for the pandemic, we actually were planning to go meet the twins this year, but that hasn't happened. So we'll probably meet the siblings once we can fly again. But I do show him their pictures and I say their names to him. And I said, now he's starting to talk, so he can say sister and he can say brother. And he has some of the books for donor-conceived kids. So there is one about having donor siblings. I forget the name of it now. I think it's I've Got Dibs. And it's so cute. And it talks about all of the aspects of them that they have in common, which I really like, because all of the siblings, they're all multiracial because my donor is half white, half Chinese. And so all of the kids have a variety of races with moms and so on. But all of the kids so far have the same eyes and the same cheeks, and they very clearly resemble. So he's growing up knowing that he's donor conceived and understanding that he has siblings. And when he's old enough, he can decide what he wants to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's similar to how I'm thinking. Like my son will definitely know he's donor conceived, know that he has siblings, you know, that the donor helped more than one family and that there are other children out there. And when I think about it, explaining it to a child, it seems complicated just because it's not the norm. But it really is not that complicated. I mean, children understand, like, for example, I have a sister. My child will call my sister Aunt Sarah. But to me, she's not my aunt. She's my sister. You know, I mean, they understand that we have these complex, like that different people have different roles. And so for them to understand that this child is a half sibling to you, I don't think it has to be as complex as we kind of make it out to be.
No. And I guess for me, it's kind of okay, whatever, because I have a half sister. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, oh, okay, that's my sister. Like I grew up knowing that's my sister. I don't think of her as a half. Right. We just grew up in different houses.
And I guess that's the question is, are these siblings, if they're not growing up together, because what makes your sister is the fact that you grew up together. You know, the biology doesn't matter as much as the experience. And when these children don't have that shared experience, are they just strangers who happen to share DNA, or are they siblings, or are they something else, or are they? And that's where I think the word dibbling, even though it's a little cheesy, it's nice to have a word that means donor sibling, because it's a different relationship than
it is different.
The kid you fight with in the next bedroom over, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. After I had him, I became very interested in what their experience is like. And so I've started listening to some of the podcasts. There are podcasts from donor conceived adults, and a lot of them have contact with their dibblings. And then there are some of them on Instagram as well. And so, I mean, their level of comfort and closeness also exists on a spectrum. Mm-hmm. Some of them aren't really interested in maintaining contact, and some of them are really close. And so I just know that eventually the kids will grow up and they'll decide what they're going to do.
Right. And I'm very interested in that. I've listened to quite a few of those podcasts, and I'd really like to get a donor conceived adult on my podcast. But I'm also aware that that's a very different generation than the way that you and I will raise our children, where it's the disclosure happens so early that the child doesn't remember a time when they didn't know that they were donor conceived or that they have donor siblings. Whereas a lot of the people on those podcasts find out because they did 23andMe, you know, when they were in college, or they, you know, they were older and they're like, oh my God, it's this big shocking secret. And so we hear about this trauma, and really the trauma is the secret, not the conception story.
Correct.
And so I'm excited to be a part of, you know, a generation that's, you know, we're just more informed about how to support our kids through that experience.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, I'm a big research nerd. So I went and I looked to see what the research says about donor conceived kids and their families. And generally speaking, the research says that the kids are okay. So I'm like, okay, cool. Yeah.
I do want to ask you about your more professional questions, but before we go there, are there any other parts of your single mother by choice story or experience that you would like to share?
I have had a couple of people ask me what I would advise other women who are planning to go on this path. I think for me, the biggest surprises were cost. You hear that kids are expensive, but I don't think you really see it until you actually have to pay the bills. So there were hospital bills, and daycare is actually more than my mortgage. And so what I tell people is, if you're doing this on your own, get your money right first. And if you're already on your path, get your money right now to plan ahead, because it is costly. The second part is to make sure that you have a support system. My support system, yes, it includes my three babysitters, but it also includes my friends who I could just talk about just regular things like what's on TV or non-mom stuff, because so much of my life is now work and mom. I also am a person and I have other things to talk about. And then join a community of people who are going down this road, like being on the Facebook groups or the Instagram, whatever the case might be. That's really, really helpful, just because people don't understand this process because they haven't lived the experience. And I actually had one friend of mine, she is a single mother, but not by choice. Her ex-husband passed away when her child was very young. And she said to me that she didn't really agree with the whole single mother by choice title. She found that it was exclusionary. Mm-hmm. And I had to say to her, I can understand what you're saying, but we're not the same. We just aren't. There are things that we share in common as single mothers because we're raising these kids on our own, and the day-to-day struggle, we can understand that, but there are aspects that are just not the same.
Mm-hmm. I found that too. There are some groups here. I live in Austin, Texas, and I joined a Facebook group for single parents in Austin. And I think that lasted about a day because I was like, I don't have custody battles and, you know, deadbeat dad issues and, you know, all of that. Yeah. I was like, I don't even want to talk about this. This is not the energy that I want surrounding my pregnancy or my parenting. And
exactly.
It's wonderful for them that they have each other.
The great thing about the internet is that there are communities for literally everything now.
For sure.
So I am sure there's a community out there of parents who lost their spouse and are raising kids on their own.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lots of different stories out there. And that's what I love. That's kind of the whole purpose of this podcast, is to get all different kinds of stories out there. I was so certain when I started this podcast that I was just going to hear my story over and over and over, because it just seemed like, of course, this is what we're all going through. And I was so surprised that I thought, for me, age was very much a factor in, okay, I am doing the math and I have just sort of run out of time to meet someone because I'm not willing to have a child with someone I've known for a year or less. And I'm also, I don't want to be older than 40, which that was, you know, like the math just kind of worked out where I was like, this has got to happen now. And I don't have a partner, so I'm doing this on my own. So I assumed everyone I talked to was going to have that same age kind of time crunch. And the first few interviews I did, they were all significantly younger than me. I think I had two that like were turning 30. I was like, oh my gosh, what is going on? It's just very different.
Yeah, the twins, our diblings, their mom is in her 20s as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, everybody's story is different.
Yeah. Well, so you touched a little bit on how important it is to kind of have your financial world in order. And that sounds like something that's become a big passion for you. And kind of how I stumbled upon your work was your podcast that is called Healthy Wealthy Roots. And do you want to tell us more about that?
Yeah, so this year with the pandemic, I had the time to kind of recuperate and figure out, okay, what exactly is going on with me financially and where do I go from here? Like I said, the first year of my baby's life is very much a blur now. I very literally was in survival mode and just taking a day at a time. And because of how difficult the pregnancy was, and then all of the hospital visits and all of that stuff, and I bought a house and living off of Uber Eats and DoorDash, I just was racking up bills upon bills upon bills. And so this year I finally had the chance to just kind of sit and figure out what was going on. And I stumbled across the financial independence community, and their whole thing is about the fact that we don't have to wait until we're in our 60s to retire, that we can accumulate wealth very quickly if we do the right things. And my ex-husband actually is very much about it and tried to convince me a few years ago. And this year I had to tell him, yes, okay, I finally got on board. But what upset me was the fact that the stuff that I ended up learning about the personal finance world is not common knowledge. It's not taught in schools. And unfortunately, for many minority families, it's not something that people are aware of. Because like I talk with some of my coworkers who are white, and they say, oh yeah, my grandmother had bought me Disney stocks when I was a kid. And no one in my family that I'm aware of has stocks. So it made me want to share what I was learning and just make it available to whoever was interested. And then it's kind of spiraled from there. So the podcast is a combination of my experiences as well as my training. I talk about financial health, I talk about mental health, and I also am touching a little bit on the parenting and the single mother by choice journey. And I'll probably separate those out as time goes on because they're very different topics. But it has opened up a whole new world for me. And I'm very glad that I did it because there are so many people that I'm coming into contact with now who are benefiting and also educating me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love, and I know you just said they're three very different topics, but I love that you've put the three together because maybe it's just where I am in my life right now, but those three do feel very intertwined because when one is off, you're not going to do well with the other two. And so when I think about being a good parent, I think some of the barriers that might get in the way are the financial, like if I'm stressed out about how I'm going to pay for diapers, I'm not probably tuned into like what sensory activities can we be doing right now? You know, I do very much see the ties between those three. I think I shared this with you when I first reached out to you. What I love about your podcast is that you're not necessarily a seasoned expert in all of these areas. You are really in the trenches and you're teaching from a place of actively learning at the same time. And that is so, that takes away like the intimidation factor. And I didn't see this person who's like got her shit together in a way that would never be me, you know, it just felt like, okay, if she can do it, then I probably can do it too. And so I found myself really binging the episodes just because it felt unintimidating, I guess is the best word for it. So I love that. And I, what a beautiful mission to reach out to minority folks who just haven't had access to this information, and for it to feel that way for them too, that it's not some like college professor speaking about, you know, finance from like a, with an econ major and, you know, all right, of that.
Exactly. So, yeah. Yeah, I do. I am a professor, but I,
but not in finance.
Right, exactly. Not in finance. And then for me too, when I started really delving into all of this stuff, I was on YouTube and I'm listening to podcasts, and so many people are telling other people what to do. You should do this and you should do this. And for instance, in the personal finance world, if you ask anybody how to handle your investments, they're going to tell you to max out your retirement plan at work. But that's not realistic for everybody. So for instance, for me, I have a mortgage and I have a daycare tuition. How am I supposed to also put $19,000 into a retirement plan every year? And so I am more of the, okay, meet people where they're at. And that's probably because I'm a psychologist, versus preaching to people and telling them what to do, because everybody's story is different. Everybody's motivation level is different. Everybody's awareness or education is different. And so I'm glad to hear, thank you, that it is approachable, because I want it to be.
It definitely is. I'm excited for what's to come. You said you have some big plans moving forward. Do you want to talk about anything that's coming down the pike?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about it. So I do have a YouTube channel, and so far I've just been uploading the podcast episodes on there. Down the line, I'm hoping to build the YouTube channel up and actually have myself on there in video form. And then because I am seeing the need, I'm looking towards potentially specializing in financial therapy, because it's very clear to me now that, especially with the pandemic, so many people are really struggling and don't know what to do. And there very much is an overlay between mental health and finance. And so, yeah.
I've never even heard of financial therapy.
I know, who knew? It makes complete sense.
It does, but what does that look like? Is it addressing kind of the emotional issues behind your money habits?
Yeah.
Wow. So I've heard of tackling things like overeating or dieting from a more psychological place, instead of just calorie counting and keeping a food journal and all of that. So this is kind of like that for money, instead of just telling you what to do with your money. It's like, why are you doing what you're doing with your money? Why do you keep overspending or, you know, whatever?
Yep. Yeah. And then a lot of people have trauma around money. So some people grew up and their parents stole their identity and opened credit cards, and that messed them up in the beginning. Or there's financial abuse and one partner is holding all of the money and the other person doesn't have access. Or just in general, you're spending a lot and you're going on trips on your credit card and on these shopping sprees and you don't know why, and you want a better life for yourself. So those kinds of things are what financial therapists address. So,
interesting. I'm very excited about the work that you're doing. Is there anything else that you want to share about your podcast, or how all of those different topics of finances and psychology and parenting tie together?
The way that I think about it, everybody has money at some point in life. Even the people who are panhandling on the street, they get money at some point. And everybody has mental health in some way, shape, or form. And so why not talk about both? Because everybody has it. The parenting piece is just as an aside, because of what I do and who I am. And so my focus is more so on the money and the mental health piece. But whatever I can share about parenting and child development and all of that stuff, I'm more than happy to. I'll give you a little bit of a teaser. In the new year, when I start the new season, I do have an episode that I'm going to be doing on personal finance for single parents.
Yay.
Because I'm seeing, okay, there are certain things that I maybe could have done differently, or advising other parents, particularly now with the pandemic, a lot of my patients' parents are kind of struggling and figuring things out. So that's going to be coming down the pike.
That's great. Well, I'm so excited to hear what comes next for you. And I thank you so much for being so open with your story and sharing about your whole journey. I know it'll bring people a lot of comfort to hear from you and just to relate and feel a little bit less alone.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to share before we go?
So the podcast is Healthy Wealthy Roots. The website is healthywealthyroots.org. And I am on Instagram, also Healthy Wealthy Roots, and YouTube, same thing.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing. And I am so glad that we've connected.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Single Greatest Choice podcast. I'm your host, Katie B. You can learn more about me, this podcast, and the Single Greatest Choice coaching at my website, www.singlegreatestchoice.com. Or find me on Instagram at single_greatest_choice. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a minute to rate and review in iTunes. That helps more women to find our show. Until next time, I'm sending you all of my love and support as you go about making the choices that will create a life you love.